Madam Secretary, I'm very happy that you're able to join us here for a podcast as part of the Ambassador's Corner. And I'm freezing here because I know I can edit it. So today is October 29th, 2019, and we're very pleased to be joined by the 23rd Secretary of the U.S. Air Force, the Honorable Deborah Lee James, who is here for a series of talks, and she will be the inaugural speaker this evening with the Charleston Library Society's co-hosted Ambassador's Corner, which we are kicking off with a conversation that I think will be really interesting and well attended. And Secretary James has just published a new book, Aim High, Chart Your Course and Find Success, which is a great read. And it's particularly interesting in the management category that you shared so much of your personal history too. It was really direct, and I think that made a really powerful impression on me, and I'm sure it will on the young people that it's particularly aimed at. I wonder if you could tell me why'd you write this book, and what would you like the readers to learn from it?
Well, first, may I just say, Jim, it's delightful to be back here at the College of Charleston and to be able to interface with you and the faculty and the students. It's really been a delightful several days. So thank you so much for having me here.
So happy you're here.
I wrote Aim High, Chart Your Course and Find Success for a couple reasons. First of all, I have been a great beneficiary throughout my life of fantastic mentorship, people who have taken an interest in me, who have advised me, who have explained their career path, their story, and through those stories and through that advice, it's helped me chart my own path and navigate my own path through life. So mentorship is big with me, and by writing a book at this stage in my life where I'm able to share my lessons learned, both the positive success stories, but equally important, the times that I have fallen flat on my face, and what did I learn from those failures, and how did I pick myself back up and go forward. By sharing those stories, it's a way that I feel that I'm able to mentor on a broader basis. So that was really the primary reason I wrote the book. Mm-hmm. The reason, I'll say the second reason why, particularly why I shared some of the personal stories as well as the professional stories, is many people can't necessarily relate to what it is to be the Secretary of the Air Force or what it is to be a U.S. ambassador representing our nation abroad. But everybody can relate to stressful situations in the workforce, challenges that are very, very difficult to overcome, problems that we have to navigate through, and the constantly changing world that we find ourselves in. Everybody can relate to that. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to share that piece of me, again, not just the successful things, but the things that have been the great disappointments in life, because it's so important that we be able to bounce back. And I wanted everybody to be able to relate to this book.
You also, in the book, you describe, you basically, it's almost a cheat sheet for success, and built around the pillars. And I'm really taken with the way you presented that. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit and what that means as you're building a career.
Well, in the Pentagon, which is a world of many acronyms between the military services, pretty much on day one, I learned an important acronym, which is the BLUF, the bottom line up front. And so the bottom line up front for my life, this book, and how I have created a formula for myself that I want to share with others, for personal and professional success and fulfillment, is there's three key action areas that everyone needs to take. The first pillar is chart and navigate your own course. So that is to say, it's up to you, it's up to me. We need to seize the moment and take responsibility for our own choices and develop the plan of attack of what we want to do with our lives. And there's strategies under this, but the most important strategy to me is always to have a plan A, a course that you want to follow and build toward that course, but at the same time, be prepared to pivot to what I call plan B. That is to say, be open to new opportunities that may present, or if your plan A doesn't work out, be prepared to look into something else because you don't know what you're going to find purposeful and meaningful until you try. So that's the first pillar. The second pillar is lead and inspire teams. Everything happens in teamwork, and as a leader, your job is to inspire those people who you hope will follow to accomplish those important goals. And then the third relates to the goals. It is get things done. Mm-hmm. And how do we do this in this constantly turbulent and changing world? I think there's a five-step process that we can all use, and I try to lay that out in the book.
Why don't you talk about those steps, those five steps, because I think they're really useful tools too.
The five steps to me, which I've used at home, I've used them in business, I've used them in my government career, regardless of the challenge or the problem that you're trying to solve or advance the ball on, you need to begin with phase one, which is investigate. So that is to say, what are the facts? What does your data tell you? Mm-hmm. And very importantly, what do the people who care about this issue, who are your stakeholders, what are their perspectives and what are they thinking? So that is part of the investigate phase. It's defining the problem. Mm-hmm. The second phase is what I call communicate. And this is where, now that we know the problem, we have to explain it to others and we need to build a case for action and change. And I'm calling communicate step two, but it really is a continuous process. You have to keep it up. The third phase is activate. Now that we understand the problem, we've explained it and built a case for action to others. Now what are we going to do that's different than what we have done before? And so this is where there are programs and initiatives where you would then attempt to advance the ball and change course in some way. Next is iterate, which is a recognition of no matter our best intentions, our first plan is not likely to be perfect and we may need to change pieces of it out. We may need to negotiate, we may need to iterate in some important ways and we need to be open to that. And lastly is follow-up, because nothing ever happens once and done, and you need to, as a leader, continue to ask the questions, call the meetings, and ask for the follow-up, and measure everything that you possibly can measure in terms of progress.
You've actually used a lot of case studies from your own life and your own experience to highlight how these work in action, and one that I'm really interested in, and it also highlights the need to allow a certain amount of risk-taking, but on the other side, there's this expectation of perfection that sometimes is unrealistic and really unhealthy in a workplace. But it's the scandal in the nuclear enterprise, and I wonder if you could just discuss that a little bit and how that highlights some of the challenges that you faced.
I was a brand new Secretary of the Air Force, about 3 weeks on the job, and I had thought through a plan of action and three goals that I wanted to achieve and a travel schedule that would allow me to highlight the themes that I wanted to pursue as Secretary of the Air Force. And boom, something happened and everything changed. And that, of course, was the scandal that you are referring to, in which we had cheating on a proficiency exam among the young officers who are standing watch and controlling the most powerful weapons in our arsenal, which are the nuclear land-based weapons of the U.S. Air Force. And I immediately knew it was big and it was important, and I had to give it top attention, so I set aside my plan A and pivoted at this moment to plan B, which required that immediate attention. And there was a quick, I will say, rapid-fire investigate phase as to exactly, you know, what happened, what could we determine within these first few days, was the nuclear arsenal safe and secure, and then, of course, once we determined that it was, why in the world did these young people cheat on these exams, and was there more to the story than just this isolated cheating situation? The communicate phase started within just a few days, where we made the decision we were going to go public with this information and tell the Congress, the press, let the American people know, here's what we know, here's what we don't yet know, but here's how we will find out. We will have accountability here, we will make changes, and we'll come back to you and report more as we find out more. I then flew out to these bases to participate a little bit directly in the follow-on investigate phase, which was not only receiving the briefings and getting data, but it was also talking to the stakeholders, which included general officers at the top of the heap, but it also included the young people and everybody in between. And I tried to do focus groups to gain insights from the people as to what was going on. It was really from those focus groups that it opened my eyes to that there was a much bigger issue in the nuclear enterprise. It was issues of how we trained people, how the morale was faring, how the equipment had become very, very old and the maintenance was not up to par, and how we needed to invest in the next generation. All of these issues came to the forefront, partly from those focus groups. So after that, we activated. That is to say, we came up with a lot of changes that we instituted, and we pumped more money into the system and took a variety of actions there, which, by the way, we didn't get completely right the first time around, which is why we iterated as we learned more. And the follow-up began almost immediately, because pretty much every single month after this occurred, I was asking to see the data on the new initiatives. How were we faring? Were the people on scene feeling the difference in the way we were now managing and training and so on? And I returned to those bases and did more focus groups over time so that I could keep my finger on the pulse of what our people at all levels were saying and doing. So I've just gone through the five phases there. In many cases, they're happening simultaneously. All the while, we'd be updating Congress and updating periodically to the press because people were clamoring to know. And flash forward several years later, I can't say that every last problem was solved, but I do think there was a lot of good action that came out of what started out to be a bad situation. And the interesting thing, the most interesting thing of all that I learned from that, is that these young people didn't cheat on that proficiency exam in order to pass it and meet standard. Rather, they cheated in order to get 100%, a perfect score, month after month after month, because this is a very highly tested and constantly pressured group. So they didn't cheat to pass, they cheated to get 100%. And why? Because that was the way our young people were either getting promoted or not. So if you talk about putting in place the wrong incentives, boy, that seemed like the wrong incentive. So needless to say, we stopped doing that, but it also uncovered many other morale issues and problems that we were able to address.
That's a really good example of how you exercise leadership when you're in an obvious leadership role, and that communication and engagement that you personally gave to the problem was probably key to solving it, or at least resolving it to the satisfaction of your constituencies. What would you say to somebody who's just starting out about the need to develop leadership skills? How important is it for a young person as they're beginning to, I mean, they don't necessarily know where their career is going to take them, but how do you go about developing that skill set?
Well, I think particularly for young people, it's important in your earliest years to focus on your collaboration skills with your peers. Everything happens in teams nowadays, and a young person coming right out of school is likely to be an individual contributor for a certain number of years, but that is still very important that you get along with your peers and be able to collaborate in a team environment. I think it's also important to build your competency in whatever your chosen field is, because as you rise up through the leadership chain, the people who will look up to you want to know that you have competence in the area that you are leading. So focusing on that individual competency in the early years is also important. I would also suggest young people read books of people perhaps that they admire, other leaders that they've seen on the world scene, and find out the personal stories of how different leaders have done it. I think you'll find there's more similarity than dissimilarity among who we consider to be top leaders. It really does boil down to relationship building, inspiring the workforce. It requires valuing of people, meaning listening to people, not just communicating orally one way, but listening and taking their input. These are the qualities of, I think, great leaders, and those who can see beyond what might be a confusing and foggy situation and nonetheless be a calming influence and say, there's an opportunity on the other end of that fog, and here's how we're going to go about getting that opportunity.
What would you say to a college student today that their role should be as a citizen?
I think it is really important that all of us, and especially our young people, that we go on the offense when it comes to learning and getting at the understanding what are the facts. And one of the most dangerous situations I think we face in our society today is that facts are being constantly put into dispute. It used to be that facts were facts and opinions were opinions, and you certainly were allowed to have your opinions, and opinions could differ, but facts were facts. Facts were based on evidence and data, and so often today we just dispute what those facts are, which I think is a dangerous thing, because if we can't get back to consistently relying on facts and evidence and data, where will we be? So I think young people have to take it upon themselves to aggressively check different sources and make sure that they understand the difference between a fact and an opinion. Mm-hmm. They're entitled to their opinion, but they're not entitled to their own facts. Right. None of us are. So I think nobody's going to do that for them, because they will be bombarded from all these sources. They need to go on the offense and seek that out for themselves. And then secondly, I think young people need to vote. They need to have their voices heard. They shouldn't sit out this next election. They shouldn't mm-hmm. sit out any election, because having apathetic citizenry, that's another, I think, danger that all Western societies face.
Would you advise someone to think about public service, and why would you advocate for that as a meaningful way to build a purposeful life?
Well, you just said the magic word. So there is great purpose in public service. I think all of us know people who work for the paycheck alone, and of course we all need to earn our compensation. But those who work solely for the paycheck versus those who, yes, I get my paycheck, but wow, I'm really passionate about my work, I'm inspired by my work, I think those are the truly satisfied and fulfilled people in life, and they enjoy their work much more so than the people who are there for the money alone. So in the government, you can find such purpose. You can find it in the private sector as well. The key is to look for that purpose that is going to make you happy, that you can translate for yourself, that you are contributing to something that's bigger than just yourself. That to me is the key. And the other thing I would tell young people is your government needs you. Your government needs smart young people to keep us fresh in the government and to keep us thinking about new ways of thinking, new technologies. So it's a little bit of a duty, and you can do it for a few years and pivot to the private mm-hmm. sector. You could start at the private sector, but then consider a tour of duty, so to speak, in the government, because we're all in this together, and you'll benefit in your own lives from having both experiences.
This reminds me, actually, of one of the stories that's in the book that connects public service, your private career, but also Charleston. And I wonder if you could just tell about the time you spent here working on the MRAP.
I was an executive for a company named SAIC from about 2007 until 2011, based here in Charleston. And our top customer was the Navy at Spaywar. During that era, if you think back, what was happening across the world, and particularly in the Middle East, the war was raging in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and our troops were dying primarily not because of hostile fire, but primarily because they would be transiting and they would hit a roadside bomb, or as we call them, IEDs. And the IED would explode and it would kill the people within or seriously injure them. That was the number one danger to our troops back then. So I was participating under the direction of Spaywar, my team and I, in a program called MRAP, Mine Resistant Ambush Protected Program. And it was a very exciting program. These were new designed vehicles which had more resistance to the blasts of these mines. And it was such an important program because we had to get it done and get it done quickly so that our troops would be better protected. So if you think about from a program management standpoint, we had to suddenly hire hundreds of people. I remember that first year we canceled Christmas. We ran three shifts at the plant. I mean, it was everybody, you know, come to attention, and this is the number one thing. And we were getting the job done on time and on budget, and periodically we'd have VIPs come from Washington. So we had the Secretary of Defense, we had the CEO of our company, we'd have senators and congressmen, and eventually it became a little ho-hum, because mm-hmm. each one would want the work to stop for maybe 5 minutes so that they could address the workforce. So we would always, of course, dutifully listen, but like I said, it got a little boring after a while. The best of all the speakers, however, turned out to be the lowest level people on the pecking order, and the best speakers turned out to be an Army sergeant and an Army private. And when the workforce stopped to listen to them, this is what they said. They said, we have direct and personal experience with the MRAP program because, you see, we were riding in an MRAP in Iraq, and we hit one of these very, very powerful IEDs. And it was so powerful, and everyone was so shook up inside, we blacked out. But we were told afterward that this multi-thousands of pounds worth of a vehicle was blown 15 feet into the air because of the power of these explosions that occurred. And we came crashing back down to Earth. And when we came to and everybody looked around, by God, we all walked away from that with our limbs intact and with our lives. And we've all seen our families. And thank you, they said to our workforce, because your efforts saved our lives. And I just remember this workforce, which was primarily men, and they were primarily blue-collar operators, welders and mechanics and people of this nature, there wasn't a dry eye in the house. They literally, you know, touched the hearts, these two men, of all of this workforce. And that is what I call purpose, where we felt like, wow, we are working on a really important program here.
It's a powerful motivator, and that level of gratitude certainly.
Yes.
When someone can express that in such a meaningful way, you know, it doesn't get any better than that.
Right.
Okay, last question. How important do you think, or what would you say is the importance of global fluency or being globally engaged?
It is super important. It is super important. We are in a global world. We are in an interconnected world. World trade happens among most nations nowadays, and it's going to remain that way. So to have some of that fluency, to have language knowledge, to understand something about regions of the world which are very, very different from our own, that is a big plus no matter what profession you end up in life, whether you're in the government, whether you're in the private sector. To have that global perspective is just a huge bonus in any profession.
Madam Secretary, thank you very much. Please come back again.
I will. Thank you, Jim.
Okay.